Yisroch.
All right. All right, everyone, good evening. Tonight we're going to end a few minutes earlier than normal. Okay, so let's go. We are up to this 10th step, and this week's Torah portion is the portion of Kiseite. So let's start with the step. The 10th step reads that continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admit it. In other words, the 10th step is not introducing anything novel, anything new. The 10th step is to continue doing what we have mentioned before. I think it was the Ikir and the 8th step. So I want to speak about the idea of maintenance, or repeating a good behavior. When we repeat something that we have done beforehand, are we accomplishing anything new, or are we only maintaining that which we have accomplished until now? What is it new in quality or is it new in quantity? Okay, let me word it like this. When a person did not practice at all the 8th step, a person never took an inventory, a person never made a real, honest introspection, a person never did tshuva, when they do it the first time, something huge is happening in their life. Something which was never done is being done, which obviously brings about a growth. When a person goes ahead now and repeats it again, is it fair to say that the second time you are repeating it, now that it's a repetition, it's not like the first time. Of course there is growth, but it's the growth that took place when we practice the 8th step is a lot greater than the growth of the 10th step. That's what I was trying to ask. In other words, when people repeat things, human nature is for sure that way. When you do something for the first time, especially something good, which normally would mean it's challenging and difficult, so the first time you do it, there's the novelty. In other words, you are energized to do it because at least I'm doing something new. But once you have done it already, and now we're speaking about the 10th step, I'm going to continue to do the same thing. Is it not inevitable that people lose enthusiasm because of the lack of novelty? Or is there a way of understanding repetition on a much deeper level, which will make us understand that when we are repeating something, not only are we still doing the same good thing that we did until now, but actually when we start repeating, when we start continuing a good behavior, we are accomplishing something new that was never accomplished and that cannot be accomplished when we did it for the first time. How does that sound? And that's what I'm aiming at. That would be a lot easier. In other words, if we would appreciate... Let's be real. Look at most people in life. Most people in life experience will tell you that when they started something new, I don't mean to say that they get bored after the first time, not. But when they do it, in all levels, many people that I know that became religious, for example, Jewish people that were not religious and they became religious. So for the first couple of years when they were growing, there was a certain magic. There was a certain wow. And then, all right, now I'm continuing the good hard work. Very nice. But there's a certain novelty that's lacking. There's a certain glow that's no longer there. That's most people's experience in any area in life. It's called boredom. Where does boredom come from?
Repetition.
From repetition.
Could be less fearful to do it the second time, but I think it's still very humiliating.
Oh, no doubt about it. No, the challenges are always going to be there. So the humiliation will be there. But the novelty, the payoff, the feeling of, wow, I did something that I never did before. And look how good this feels. This is real growth. That is something that once you feel a couple of times, you feel it again. But how do we, in other words, the question is, how do we make the 10th step something new, a new step?
By continuing doing it.
Can we read
the 10th step again? The 10th step is continue to take personal inventory, etc. In other words, the 10th step is more or less maintenance of the previous steps. More or less.
The 4th step.
Well, the 8th step. Four step. Thank you. Okay. So I want to say the following. In brief, whenever a person is dealing with negativity, regardless if it's outside of us, and more importantly, which is going to be the focus of tonight, whatever needs to be dealt with, which is not good, which is bad, is inside of me, I can never transform darkness into light, something unholy into holiness, without first suppressing it. It is only after a person first suppresses it that eventually will enable the person to re-engage with it and ultimately to transform it. Is that clear? There's a huge difference between suppressing something, between trying to ignore something. So I have an instinct, I have a desire to do something, the instinct is there, and until now I was allowing its expression, which was bad. The first step needs to be that I have to learn how to get mastery with the help of Hashem, and not allowing that desire, that instinct, to express itself through me. That's called I'm suppressing it, but that instinct is still there. And it can wake up any moment and find expression, God forbid. So the long-term goal would be to transform that instinct. That instinct itself should want to express itself in a healthy way. Because the root of the root of the root of any instinct is ultimately good. It's just that in our mind, in our heart, because of our limited experience, we think that we want A. We think that we desire A, and which is why we go and get it, even though the A might not be something which is good for us. And ultimately, the desire is coming from something very holy and kosher. That's called we are transforming that desire. But people can only dream about getting to that, which is really a Mashiach moment, when they first deal with it by suppressing it. If you don't suppress it first, if you don't fight with it first, then you can never transform. And I would propose that, like you said, if it's step number 4 or if it's step number 8, that the first time people are dealing with these steps and they're taking inventory and they are bettering themselves, what they are bettering is not their instinct, they are bettering their behavior. They are taking control over their external part, which is, as we keep on mentioning, what's called in Kabbalah, we are taking control over the garments of ourselves, and our garments are our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. So before, the instinct was in control, and if I had an instinct to do A, B, or C, I just ended up doing it, regardless my understanding about how bad that might be to me and to others. And I knew that, but for some reason I just couldn't control myself. And the first goal, the initial goal, will be to dig deeper and to ask Hashem to help me, and eventually reach the level where I am in control over my garments. And I am thinking, speaking, and doing that which God wants me to do, that which is ultimately good for me. But the root is still there. The issue is still there. But it's not manifesting so strong. The monster became diminished. But the monster is still there. When we begin repeating something, we have to understand that repetition isn't only repeating something good. That repetition is the key to transformation. And once we start in step number 10, and this continued obviously doesn't end with step number 10, but we go over the steps, the idea of repetition, the idea isn't only doing something good again, which that in itself is great, but the novelty of repetition is because when we start repeating any good behavior, we begin something new, which is transformation. And transformation is something that we never dealt until we repeat a good behavior a certain amount of times. And let me show you how this concept works in an area in this week's portion and in many other areas in the Torah. Now, there's understanding this and there's really getting it deeply and getting excited about it, because that will be the goal, to be excited about repetition. You know, in any area in life, when people learn something new, so you learn, you know, people who like studying Torah, you learn a page of the Talmud, the first time it's like, nice, wow. Or you learn the Parsha. So the first time you read it, you know, if you like it, it's nice. But then when you repeat it again and again and again, certain people get bored. Okay, I know, I heard that. It's nice to hear it again. It doesn't work that way. Not fakeness. It's not fake. Don't call it fake. The power of fighting against. Let's go back to. No, I'm not. No one thinks they're transformed. That's the whole. We're not. No, we're not. No.
What's that feeling when you learn something new?
It's an accomplishment.
You get this feeling.
You get a new. Yes and no. That you're different. I don't know. That the same you has new information. That the same you is connected deeper to God. That you are a different you. Repeating? I think because they don't appreciate what repeating is really accomplishing. It's not something that can be measured initially, but if we would understand deeper of what repetition does, we would be a lot more excited about it. So let me go to one of the many mitzvahs that we have in this week's parsha, which is a fascinating issue. And it's the issue about mixing different parts of the world together. There are certain mixtures that one is prohibited to do. Where do we have this in this week's portion? We have it in chapter 22. It's a little bit towards the further. It's not in the beginning. It's not in the middle, but it's in our page 1268. If you want to look inside for the web audience, we're going to Patek 22, chapter 22. The first, we can even call this a mixture. A cross is, we're not allowed to cross dress. That's a prohibition in the Torah. It's in chapter 22, verse 5. And we'll see soon maybe the deeper meaning of cross-dressing and about garments, which is what we're talking about, spiritual garments, the things that we do and how it affects us, how the outside transforms the inside, and therefore the cross-dressing can have a very deep, unhealthy effect on the person. By the way, I just want to say something interesting, that many people hold that women are not allowed to wear tefillin because it's called cross-dressing. Just putting it out there for the web audience, and if I take slack for it, that's fine. But today we're living in L.A., and many people here don't understand why women can't wear tefillin, so they should know that the many halachic authorities hold that that's biblically prohibited because... That's because you can disagree with that. But that's a...
Okay, I always thought they were holy enough to wear...
No. Okay, let's just leave it out. Yeah?
Why certain women shave their heads?
That's a different discussion.
Isn't that cross-dressing?
No, it's not cross-dressing. No, it's not putting dressing, it's putting something on you. Not taking something off you. Okay. Now, the next one, we go to the next page over here, page 1270. And the Torah together in verse 9, in Pasuk 9, Pasuk 10, and in Pasuk 11, the Torah is mentioning most of the prohibitions in the Torah about crossing different things. So in Pasuk number 9, the Torah says, Leisizra karmacha kolayim. That a person is not allowed to plant one's vineyard with a mixture. One of the words, one of the interpretations of kiloyim is to mix or to destroy. Kilayon, it destroys. We'll explain that in a moment. And just to know what this pasuk is talking about, biblically, what one is prohibited here to do is if you have a vineyard, one is not allowed to plant in a vineyard two grains. It means, for example, we have five grains in the Torah. And that is wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. You cannot take two of any of the five that I just mentioned, two of them, and plant it together with a seed of a grape. That is what the biblical prohibition is over here. You cannot mix together grains. That's correct. There's a lot of details we're not going to get into right now, but this verse is speaking about crossing over, particularly grains and trees, and specifically the vine. Just to understand that grains and trees are different according to the following. That grains are articles that you need to plant every time to eat. I mean, you plant it, it grows once, and that's the end of that. If you want to eat again, you have to plant again. It's one type of category. A tree, by definition, is something that you plant, and now that you planted it, the tree is there. And every year, or twice a year, or who knows how often, the same tree is going to give fruit again and again and again. To a certain degree, correct. It's not called a grain, but this type of criterion is important. For example, who knows what blessing you make on a banana? Hadamah, did you ever see a banana? Is it a tree or is it a vegetable? What does it look like to you?
It grows
on a tree, so why do you make the blessing which you make on something that grows on the earth? You know, a carrot grows on the earth, an onion grows on the earth, a banana grows on a tree. So why do you make the blessing that you make on the carrot? This is the definition, because a carrot you plant once, and it only grows once. The same thing is with a banana tree. Now, where the bananas grew from the tree, that part of the tree will never give forth bananas again. Just the banana tree, because of God, God gave it a nature that it somehow plants itself again. So there will be a new offshoot the next year or the next season. But that, if you ever saw a banana tree, it grows in a certain area and that's it. Only grows once in that place. So you're not allowed to, the Torah is specifically speaking about vines and two grains together. That's one prohibition. Then you have verse number 10. The Torah says you're not allowed to plow a field with an ox and a donkey. Just parenthetically, people say, people who are shatchan and people who make shaduchim, that if they make a match between two characters that are not matching, they violated this prohibition. In other words, life is not so, you know, it's a good, it's not joking. They say that you have to be careful what you're doing because, you know, life is challenging. And if two people are very different, so that's the, you know, one is the ox and one is the donkey, you know, that's the gate, it doesn't work. So be careful. So for those of you out there that, it's a big mitzvah to make shaduchim, but try harder. Bite it. And the next, literally it means when you're plowing a field, you cannot harness two animals that are of different species because they have different natures and they don't work with the same objectives or through the same strategies and they're going to frustrate each other. And in verse number 11, the Torah says, Leisilbas shatnes, do not wear a garment called shatnes. That's a very funny word. Again, Rashi translates shatnes. The first translation is a mixture. What cannot be mixed? Which types of strings, thread cannot be mixed? Semer, wool, upishtin, and linen. Cannot wear a garment that was made together out of wool and linen. Now there's another cross mixture that is not mentioned here, which needs to be understood why it's not mentioned here. It's mentioned three times in the Torah. Who knows what milk and meat. Which is mentioned many times. The Torah doesn't mention it the way I just said it. The Torah says you cannot cook a kid in its mother's milk. But we understand that that means that you cannot cook meat and milk together. And if someone else cooked meat and milk together, not only can you not eat it, you can't derive any benefit from it. And then there are many rabbinic laws. The rabbis said that even if you're not cooking it together, you just mixed it together, you can't eat it. And they added, even if you ate one, you have to wait a certain amount of time until you eat the other, and we don't have the same utensils, etc., etc., etc.
How did we get this idea that, you know, we can't eat from the baby's meat?
Let's leave that for another time. That's a good question. It's like in almost all the verses of the Torah, without the oral tradition, we would never get there. However, having said that, now that we know what God meant by using the words that He used, there is a logic why God used that type of expression. And the Talmud deals with it. I'll leave it for another time. Okay. So I want to focus in on all these mixtures when God says you cannot cross two things together. First of all, these mitzvahs are in the category of decrees that are beyond human understanding. They're called chukim. However, like in most cases, having said that it's beyond our understanding, our sages propose different insights which don't fully explain it, and we need to understand that we don't fully understand it. We don't even understand it a lot. But a little thread, a little insight, a little understanding is something that God granted us, even in these commandments that are beyond human logic. So I want to speak about the garment commandment. Then we'll have time to go to the other ones. And going back to what we're speaking here, because we started the conversation just by reminding ourselves that in Kabbalah, human action, things that we do, words that we speak, and ideas or thoughts that we think are called the garments of the person. And the goal of the 12 steps is both to improve our garments, that our behavior should be good. And obviously that's not enough, because everyone wants to have good behavior. Why am I not behaving properly? Because of something deeper than my garment, because of my emotions, because of the way my mind is wired, that those are wired in a way that are somehow making me, or they are finding expression in negative behavior. So when I want to better my behavior, I have to both fight with my behavior, and I have to fight with deeper than my behavior. And we started the class by explaining that once we start the 10th step, once we begin repeating a system, repetition really deep starts digging a lot deeper. Repetition really begins the process that we can call transformation, which will automatically better our garments. I want to just focus in a moment on the power of garments, about what repetitive behavior could do. It does a lot more than we think it does. It's not just repeating a good thing again and again and again. Something beyond that. So let's speak about this type of mixture. Now, so if we want to understand properly why God does not allow us to mix different types of threads in a garment, we have to have a better understanding about the concept of a garment. Why do we wear garments? And why do we wear garments? What does the Torah speak about when the Torah is telling us about garments? I'm sorry? He said it's a shame, to cover the shame. He's using words in the Torah. It's interesting that in Hebrew, how do you say a garment? Levush. How do you say shame in Hebrew? Busha, the same roots that they come together, yeah?
But I was reading that when Hashem said that he's going to honor the convert like with the garment, like he's going to give the convert a garment.
Show me that verse.
I don't know now. I can show you later. But, and I was reading the commentary, it said that the garment is also related to honor Hashem.
Oh, well, very good. So well, hold on. So very good. So let's go like this. When the Torah relates the story of Adam, that Adam, the Torah says that both of them, man and woman, were ungarbed, were arumim. And right away the Torah says, v'loi, and they were not ashamed. There was no shame. And after they ate from the tree, whatever the tree was, the tree of knowing good and bad, the tree of knowledge of good and bad, so one of the first things the Torah writes is that their eyes opened up, and they realize that they're unclothed. And the Torah writes that Adam and Chava made for themselves, the Torah writes that, they made for themselves a covering for their shame out of the tree of a fig, and they made for themselves aprons or robes. And then the Torah speaks about how God went looking for Adam and Chava, and they, where are you? Why are you hiding? Who told you that you're uncovered? Did you eat from the tree? Yeah, but it was her fault. It was the snake's fault. And at the end of the story, the Torah writes, that God made for the man and for his wife, God made for them kosnois oyd. God made for them garments. So first of all, we have a repetition over here. They had garments, and then God made garments. Why did they need God's garments if they already had garments? Oh, 1 second. No, if it only would have said that they had fig leaves, you're right. But it says that they made for themselves something from the fig tree, and they made for themselves chagoyres. They made for themselves an apron. They were fully covered, and God gave them a new garment.
We weren't allowed to eat then meat or something.
That's a whole different conversation.
So what's the point of killing an animal if you couldn't eat the meat?
That's if it was from an animal, correct? Okay, that's a good question. Hashem is a better tailor, no question about it. But let me explain to you how God is a better tailor, and the power of a garment, and the purpose of a garment. So let's understand a few things in perspective. First of all, the body is called, in the Torah, it's a verse in Iyuv, he said, Oir ubasar yal bisheni. Iyuv is telling God that you clothed me with my flesh and bones, with my body. So the body is a garment to the soul. What does it mean that the body is a garment to the soul? So I'll tell you what it means. When God created Adam and Chava, initially, when they identified themselves with their soul, when they said, me was their godly part, their soul. And in their mind, and in their heart, the physical body was nothing other than a tool that was totally subservient to the needs and to the desires and to the mission of their soul. So there's a mitzvah to give tzedakah. So in this physical world, while the soul is in a body, you need a hand to give, and you need legs to walk. And every single part of the body, in their mind, was simply subservient. It was just a tool. It was just a garment serving the needs of the godly soul. Don't forget, the godly soul does not have its own agenda. The agenda of the godly soul is God's agenda. The body did not have its own agenda. The body was totally transparent for the soul. That's how it started out. Because of their eating from that tree, all of a sudden there was a disconnect between their body and their soul. And the body began to have its own agenda. The human being became self-aware. Self meaning not godly self, the lower self, the animal self. Why were they then ashamed? There are many ways of understanding it. Let me give you a good example of how you can understand the shame. The godly soul was ashamed of the body. The godly soul was ashamed that it has in it all of a sudden something that has its own agenda. How do people feel when people are doing something that is very small and petty in the eyes of someone who you look up to and you think that they're perfect and they walk in on you? Why do you get ashamed? You get ashamed because they feel ashamed. It's like there's an uncomfort over here. Oy gewalt, they are seeing that there's a part of me that is not like them, it's much lower. So before the body had its own agenda, there was nothing to be ashamed about. Every part of the body was there to serve the needs that the godly soul has. The needs of the godly soul is connected to the mission that the godly soul has. So you have to see, so it has eyes. There's no shame in having eyes. And every part of the body was only there to do what it was meant to do as far as the godly soul is concerned. There's no reason for shame. The only reason why shame came into play is when the body began to experience its own desire, its own agenda, independent of God's mission, independent of the godly soul's mission. Oh, there's something that the body enjoys, regardless if it's kosher or not. The godly soul is ashamed of that. And what do you do if you are ashamed of something? Cover it up. We began the class explaining about what the meaning, you have to first suppress something. When you suppress something, it doesn't go away. But only if it's covered. So at least you took away the shame. It's not revealed. It's not expressing itself. It's covered. All right. Is that clear? Make sense? So now we understand why did they cover their private parts? Because if there's any specific part of the body, they covered themselves entirely. Like I told you, it says they covered themselves with the fig tree. That was their private. And then they covered the rest of the body. Because the part of the body that if a person is disconnected from God, the way we all are, after that, we have our own agenda. So the self-awareness and what I like is primarily expressed in that area. And they were, and the godliness in them was ashamed of it. So it covered it. Because it should cover the whole body. The walls of modesty come from that. It's not just... No. They covered that when they dressed it, more or less the way we dress today. Not with a collar, but they covered the primary part of the body. Whatever the Torah says you have to cover. We see in Shulchan Aruch what you have to cover. The heart shouldn't see. Right? You covered the upper body and the lower body. Yeah. One second. You were about to ask a question.
Yeah. What change happened in their awareness of themselves?
Self-awareness.
But would it immediately lead to shame of themselves?
They were ashamed that they had an agenda other than God's agenda. Just that.
So they were no longer, sexuality is part of God's agenda, no procreation.
If your involvement in sexuality is solely because there's a mitzvah to procreate, or there's a mitzvah to bond with your spouse, then there's a mitzvah. But the moment you're not, your desire is not only because it's a mitzvah, then even if the godly soul and the animal soul have the same mission, have the same objective, but they're coming from different places. One is coming from self-interest, and one is coming to serving God interest. It's a whole different place.
So this animal soul was not also created by God as part of your
The animal soul that as we have now, they did not have when they were created.
So they only got that after.
That's correct. The animal soul was in the world, but not in them. They ate it. They integrated it. It became part of their psyche.
They still had a body, though.
They had a body, but the body was a garment. It means it was totally subservient to the soul. In other words, if we can imagine how a tzaddik would feel when it comes to any human activity, Adam was greater than that. But that would be something like what Adam was, just to get a picture. Because everything is in service. Everything is in service of something greater than me. This is the steps. What's all the steps? That I have to give over my will to a greater power. It's easier said than done, by far. That was Adam and Chava's life. Everything was in service. And we shouldn't fool ourselves. I know many people have a custom that when they eat something tasty on Shabbos, before they eat, they say, I'm doing this for the mitzvah of Shabbos. First of all, it's very nice. But who are you kidding? You say, at least I'm also doing it for the mitzvah of Shabbos. You'll be more honest. Also, no, which is true, nothing wrong. At least I'm honest. In other words, if not for Shabbos, would I not enjoy it? Of course I would enjoy it. If a person, a tzaddik... Huh? What was that?
That's it.
And by the way, that's why there's such a big mitzvah in having the third meal of Shabbos, especially when Shabbos goes out early, is because a person ate the Shabbos meal, they're full, and now they're only eating because it's a mitzvah. That's the mitzvah. At least I know, why am I doing it? Because God commanded me. And if not, I should be honest with myself. Now, thank God there are many areas in life that the godly soul and the animal soul want the same thing. At least we're behaving correctly. But the godly soul is ashamed of the animal in it. Oy gewalt, what is this? What is this? It likes it. And the godly soul is only serving God. Everything is for something greater than it. There's no ego at all. And the animal soul is ego. So even if it's good ego, be ashamed of it. A tzaddik would be ashamed if they have ego. Like there's that part in us that is ashamed of the lower part of us. So we cover it. Yeah, but the animal soul is not doing it because it wants to serve as God. The animal soul is not fighting the godly soul because it also wants it. Okay, so you get it for your reason. I'm getting it for my reason. But I want that. I want that. That I want was something new. Yeah.
Can you explain what the true... I feel like shame can sometimes be very, very...
I would say that the best definition I have for shame is that shame is like a nervous system, a spiritual nervous system. Which is like if someone bangs on my finger and it hurts, I don't enjoy the fact that it hurts. But I appreciate the fact that my nervous system is functioning, so I feel pain, because the pain is telling me, opa, that's not good. Don't allow someone to do that again. Versus a person who doesn't have a nervous system, and someone bangs on their finger and they don't feel pain, so they don't stop it, so that can lead them to lose their finger. So if we look at shame in that context, we're not enjoying the shame. But if there is shame, hopefully, now many people have to rewire their way they think, but if we are more or less healthy inside, then shame is like an internal alarm clock. That the godly soul doesn't like.
Today the country no shame involved.
No, they don't walk around naked. They go around with their fig leaves. Ephes, they... Okay. That was the original. That's your question.
So, saying if the custom of the world wasn't to wear clothes today, there was no shame about it.
Very good. So you make my point. In other words, why did they wear... Why did they have shame? Well, it wasn't about the nakedness, per se. It was about the fact that that part of the body is where we see more than other parts. That the body has its own agenda other than God's agenda. And that is what brought them to shame. Not of the physical part of the body.
But you shouldn't get angry. You shouldn't fight with it.
No. We should not fight with it. We should be thankful to it. What we shouldn't do is, we shouldn't try to get rid of the shame. We should get rid of the activity that brought us the shame. And not convince ourselves... There's nothing to be ashamed about, because if we repeat something enough times, if you bang your finger enough times, you will hurt the nervous system. And then you won't feel it anymore. So there are people, God forbid, that lose shame, which is a terrible thing. In other words, you go from having a lot of shame, if a person keeps on repeating that behavior, they have less shame, until they come to a point where a person loses all shame. So they think, wow, this is awesome. Nothing is nudging me inside. This is terrible. 1 second. Now, okay, Gemara, I want to get to a certain concept. Now, all of this is the clothing that Adam and Chava make for themselves, which is to suppress, to cover up something which is not ideal, which is having a self agenda, having an ego. So we try to cover it, which is what happens when we do the 4th step or the 8th step. Why did God make garments again? Because the garment that God made wasn't the same thing again, just nicer garments. God obviously was a better tailor. But it wasn't that. It changed everything. And what's everything mean? That the garments that Adam made did not heal the ego. It just covered it up. The garments that God made began a process through which, through wearing those garments, as we'll explain in a moment, a person begins to undo the real damage that was done by the sin, and a person starts to become more transparent to God. A person begins to lose one's ego. The animal starts becoming transformed. And those garments are called, like you mentioned, garments of glory. It's not just to take away a negative, but there's something positive about the garment. What is positive about the garment? That it's transforming the animal and the person. And it's starting that process. This is a long process, yeah. Everything comes from God. The source of the animal soul is not from the Satan, but okay. The evil inclination is from the Satan. The animal in the person comes from it comes from very high spiritual levels. It comes from the holy animals in the heavens. Chaya Sakoyevich. Not completely, but they're two different things. The evil inclination can only find a home in the animal soul. The godly soul would never give it space. I want you to get this. The animal soul is not the evil inclination. Okay, what do you want to say? All of the angels are called animals. All of the angels are called animals.
Oh yeah?
Oh yeah. And they're called holy animals. Chayas, holy life.
So, Raphael was
the source, all the sources of all these angels are animals. The highest angels, the highest levels of angels, or almost the highest, are called Chayot HaKodesh. Now, which can also mean holy life force, but the literal meaning is holy animals.
They represent certain animals that we know of?
Of course, all of the animals here ultimately come from those animals. You know, when Yechezkel had the vision in the Merkava, what did he see? Who was carrying God? There was a person, and there were a couple of animals. Yeah.
The animals are together.
Yeah. Correct. So here we go. So until now, again, we're going back to God. Very good. 100% correct. Yeah. I don't know what really went on. I have a couple of insights, but what really, really went on, I don't think anyone can know what really went on. But that, let's leave you a question. The question is that there's something a lot more than what it seems. Correct. Okay, let's focus here, and then we'll go back to that another time. It's not a private conversation. Listen, what do I know? I know what I read and what I hear. I can repeat to you very beautiful insights that I heard. Different, very different insights. We can give a whole class on that. But the premise of what your curiosity is coming from a very good place. What happened? They didn't eat a fruit. Maybe that's what happened physically, but something deeper than that happened. And by the way, this paradigm is on everything that we do. Don't think that even the things that we think are not that bad, when we go and do something bad, what's really happening? That's what the 12 steps are trying to discover. It's not what we think is happening. That's not what's happening. That's just the expression of what's happening, what's really happening. And that's what we always have to become curious about, because if we go to that, then we have a chance to change things. But let me go back to the garment comes. Now, to understand like this, that everything that exists in the physical world, to a certain degree, is a garment, like this gentleman in the back just read, to some type of spiritual power. Many people very wrongly think that once you go into the spiritual realm, everything is more or less the same. Everything is one. Only in the physical world do we have divisions. Right, this is very old idolatrous thoughts. This is very un-Jewish. And what's important is it's not true. God is one. But everything that is a creation from God, beginning on the highest spiritual worlds, are to a certain degree as diverse as the physical world. But it's a spiritual diverseness. There's a beautiful expression in our sages that there isn't a single blade of grass. How many blades of grass do you have in the whole world? Who knows how many trillions? Every blade of grass has its individual, so to say, angel or spiritual energy that is connected to it, and that's making it grow. Well, obviously, God is making it grow, but God is channeling that energy first through something spiritual. Again, garments. God garments Himself in a spiritual energy, and that garments Himself in something else, and ultimately, it garments itself in a blade of grass. So there's a whole system that God created, the spiritual system. So you have in the physical world day and night, you have spiritual day and night. Day and night here should not mix. It will destroy the world. So there's spiritual day and night. Day is supposed to be day, night is supposed to be night. There is land and there's sea. The land is supposed to be land. If not, it's a disaster. If God forbid, if the water goes onto the land, it kills everything. Or the opposite, if the seas dry up, it's another disaster. Just like we are very much aware in many, not in all, but in many parts of nature, that the divisions, that God made this and God made that, that they're supposed to be separate. And if one begins to infringe on the space of the other, it will destroy the other and destroy the world. All of that is really because spiritually there are spiritual energies that are not meant to commingle. They're meant to be separated. They respect each other. They honor each other. But they have to remain distinct and separate. There has to be an Havdalah. And if you begin to mingle them, you will destroy the spiritual universe. And here comes something very powerful for us to be aware. That whenever we do something in the physical world, like they ate a fruit, they ate something. Whenever you do something physically, you are doing something spiritual as well. You might not see it. You might not be aware of it. But whenever you hold on to something, what are you holding on to? I'm not just holding on to a cup. The cup is a garment. There's something in it. So if I'm grabbing onto the cup, and I'm a physical person with a physical hand, so I can only physically grab onto the cup, but through me grabbing onto the cup, I'm grabbing onto something much greater than the cup. And if I bring together, you know, there's a mitzvah before Sukkot, when we have the four species that we bring together. It's one of those mitzvahs that, what is that? Every plant has a different energy in it. And those four energies become great, become awesome when you bring them together. And you know something, before God created the physical world, they were never able to come together. But now that God created the physical universe and everything has in it is a garment to something spiritual, physically you can bring any two things together. Spiritually, you can never bring together things that are different. In the spiritual world, if things are different, they can never be brought together. How will they get together? Nothing takes up space over there. What is the thing that separates one thing from the other spiritually? What's the answer? It's different. There's no space there. So if things are different, and their difference is what separates them, if they're not meant to be together, they can never come together. But in the physical world, being that everything takes up space, and physically I can take a cup and a watch, and I can put them together. This and that are two different concepts. They're two different things, but I can bring them together. And since I can bring them together physically, whatever they represent is also coming together. In Kabbalah, there's a concept that one of the reasons why God created the physical universe is because God wanted for a certain spiritual energies to unite. And the only way that can happen is by creating a physical universe. When the right unions happen physically, that forces those same unions to happen spiritually, and it could not have happened if not for them finding a garment that is physical. This is a very, very deep concept. Let's go to let it sink in the head. So let me just finish a concept over here. If we are going, there are certain parts of the universe which are, for example, in the linen and in the wool. There are separate energies. So there's nothing wrong with linen and wool together, if it's just linen and wool. But there's no linen and wool. There's nothing physical that is a vacuum. Everything is holding something in it. There's an energy in it. The energy of the linen and the energy of the wool are one of those energies that are not allowed to come together. That's an exception. Before exceptions. They're not allowed to come together. And therefore, we're not allowed to bring these physical things together. So, I'll answer that question quickly. The tzitzis can come together. Meat and milk was allowed to be cooked in the temple together. And according to certain peoples, all of these prohibited mixtures can happen in the temple. And the quick, short, deep answer is that being that in the temple, the essence of God is revealed. The essence of God is a true oneness. When that is revealed, there is no diversity. So there's no this and there's no that. So you're not creating any chaos. But the moment we go into the world of creation, out of the temple, when things are, things have to be where they're put. Certain things should be brought together, and certain things are not allowed to be brought together. Now, people appreciate that when they learn physical science, when they learn how the world works, and you tell a person that if you put this ingredient and that ingredient, you'll make a bomb. Why? I don't care why, it's just a fact. This and that, the physicality of it, it destroys. Spiritually, you have the same thing. And physical things are garments to something spiritual.
Do you spirituality?
I'm sorry?
Do you take spirituality away from, like, it's a fact, or do you ruin spirituality and then you can lose anything?
Once you start manipulating the spirituality, you know, that's what they call black magic. So you're getting to a whole different point. It's already even more not kosher. Yeah, but that's a possible problem. But we're not, that's for sure we're not allowed to do. But one second. Now hold the thought over here. Now look at this. Let me tell you something interesting. When we understand that everything physical is a garment to something spiritual, so you have, you know, these words, you have a light and you have a vessel. Is the vessel adding something to the light? Or is the vessel just holding the light? Huh? Correct. So step number one is that since everything physical is a vessel to some light, certain things cannot be put together, so that's why you can't have these mixtures. In Kabbalah we have even a deeper concept that vessels actually bring down greater lights. Let me give you an example. Think about speech for a second. What happens when we talk? The idea, I'm going to call the idea the light, and the word is the vessel. Does that make sense? The word, without something intelligent in it, can be just gibberish, correct? It's nothing. It's like a dead rock. But if you put this word with that word with the other, there's an idea in it, so then you can enclose an idea in a word, which is an awesome thing. We just take it for granted. We don't think about it. Now, in Kabbalah underlines a very curious phenomenon. And we only find this a few times in the physical universe. I think there are four examples, or three examples. But one example is speech. When you have an idea, when you understand something, most people expressing the idea in words will make them understand it a lot deeper. How can that be? Is the word important or is the idea important? What is the spirit of it? The idea. The light is the idea. I got it. The word is just a box, it's just a container in which I put the idea and I pass it over to you. So people say what you say, that it forces you to understand it better. In Kabbalah it says it's much more than that. That a garment, much more than that. That because you put it in a word, now that you have a garment, the source of a garment is higher than the source of light. That the garment gives more light than the light gave to the garment. One second, no, this is pure Kabbalah concepts. They're very deep, and you know, when you hear too many of them, you don't appreciate them. But this is a very important concept to understand, that the keli, that the container, adds to the light.
Sure, like you have an idea, then you build that idea, so you see what you're doing, and that gives you a better picture of what the idea is.
Let me say different. Even though you already said it once and you saw the better picture, when you're going to repeat it again, there is a chance that you're going to get an insight that is infinitely greater than everything you understood until now. And what brought it down was the garment, was the words, the dead words, not the idea that you were looking at again. Correct. Correct. That's a different issue. That's a different challenge. But coming back, but just take this. This is a Kabbalah principle. This is emes. This is tzeiras emes. This is the real truth. That a garment has the power to bring down a higher light. And therefore, going back to Adam and coming back to what we started off with, when he wore the garment the first time, the goal of the garment was to cover something shameful. But when God made him a new garment, it wasn't just that it was a divine garment, but when you do something again, he's not covering it up better. The new garment brought down such an awesome light that new light began to transform the animal in Adam and Chava. And those garments are called garments of glory. And coming back to what we started out with, is that when we have a certain good behavior, so yesterday I was doing A, B, C, bad. Not good. And then I am making a real tshuva. And somehow with God's help, I managed today not to do the bad, to do the good. So initially, those garments of actions, of things that I'm doing or not doing, they're just suppressing my animal. And I have to be very fearful, which we should be. Not fearful in a negative way, but we have to be aware that I'm not healed, that the root was not addressed. By God's grace, somehow today I managed to overcome that instinct or the other instinct with God's help. And who knows tomorrow if I'll succeed or not. It's good to have that humility. I'm not healed. But be aware that every day that you succeed, it's not just another success story of today about me overcoming my negative side. It's much more than that. Every action is a garment. Every action is a garment. And every garment has the power to draw down an infinitely higher light that was never here before. And that higher light from within begins to really transform my insights. And that's the deep meaning of Natsa V'Nishma, about why Judaism underlines the importance of action. Not because we are ignoring the inner part of the person, absolutely not. We understand that the action is just external. And initially, action is only external, true. And we all know people that we can be doing the right thing and inside we're rotten to the core, true. But sooner or later, that will change. Through repetition. And it will change, when you say, by the help of God. It's not going to change by my effort. I'm unaware of my messed up wiring. I'm not even putting that much effort, which I should, on the way I feel. But simply, by putting on the garment again and again and again, it stops being a garment that covers shame and it becomes transformed into a garment of glory. That's the greatness of a garment. The garments have a tremendous power. And garments means that what I do has a tremendous power, specifically when I repeat it. Because in the beginning, the first time I do the right thing, it's not drawing anything down. And if when I speak the first time I understood it better, that was your explanation. It didn't draw anything down, I just got better clarity. I see it better. Talk about repeating. You know that people, when it comes to the religious world, when we learn Torah, we learn something again and again and again and again. People learn things 40 times. People learn things 101 times. There's a point that you know it already. You're repeating it. There are many reasons for that. Aside of memory. But the real deep mystical reason is because by simply repeating the garments of the Torah, by doing the mitzvah, you already davened yesterday. I'm repeating the same siddur. I'm doing the same exact mitzvah. I did it already. So explain it to me for me to be excited. Yeah, that also. Who knows? Maybe tomorrow, because it's who knows how many thousands of times I put on tefillin, that repetition is going to bring something totally new down. And that adds a lot of enthusiasm. It gives a lot of hope, and it gives a lot of meaning of repeating, about continuing something. I'm not just doing the same thing again. I'm starting to tap into the root of a utensil, the root of a garment, the root of a cape.
You're saying it's not, it's not adding, it's doing something new.
It's something mamish new, something much newer than the first time. The first time I'm just suppressing my animal, which is nice, because yesterday I wasn't even able to do that. And today I'm able to overcome my yetzer hara. When I'm going to do it again and again and again and again, that's beginning to internally transform. Okay, we'll stop over here. Yes.